The Art Dealer Diaries are brought to you by Medicine Man Gallery, specializing in antique Native American art, early Western art, including the famed Maynard Dixon, as well as modern art. You can find everything online at medicinemangallery.com. There's over 6,000 objects to select from. Also, the Charles Bloom Murder Mystery Series, written by yours truly, me, Mark Sublett. These can be found on Audible, eBooks, Amazon, and of course, the gallery at medicinemangallery.com. I've been wanting to do a podcast with Dominic Modolinski for a very long time. I've represented him for over a decade, for sure. But he is such an interesting, unique human being. Not like any other artist, actually, I represent, because he's not only, you know, a creative soul and he has to do it, but he's also just this all wonderluck person who has to go to the most interesting places on the planet to really feel and be a part of that environment for, you know, maybe months at a time to capture the essence of whatever it is. You know, he just got back from Mexico and he brought us some Mexico pieces. He also was just down in Ecuador, and we have Ecuadorian pieces. He was there for like 9 weeks in Ecuador while they're going through like a big major riot in the streets, kind of the country closed down type of scenario. And this is the type of places that, you know, he goes to. And sometimes he goes on these long sojourns where he's on a motorcycle for months at a time in the very, very backwoods. So it's a very unique story. You know, he comes from Poland, but he immigrates to Canada very early and goes to Canadian art school very well trained. But he loves to travel the world, whether it's the most remote places where says he's had like 100 bear encounters, that type of thing. So unique human, beautiful paintings. And I really had a great time on this podcast. I think everyone will enjoy listening to such a interesting human being. Cat. Okay. Well, today we're promoting Cat here with Dominic Modolinski. So Dominic, I've been wanting to get you on the podcast for a long time, but you're always in a different continent.
Well, I'm on North American continent most of the time, but I'm a little bit north of you, right?
Yeah. So you're out of Canada.
I'm out of Columbia, Canada, right? Yes.
Yeah. But, I mean, you just came from Mexico, right?
Yes. I decided last year that I want to spend a few months painting in Mexico due to opportunity that I had there to teach.
Oh, okay.
I was teaching for 2 weeks, both studio and plein air work. Out of a Canadian type of outfit that runs workshop, and mostly it's Canadian and American students who come there.
American. So, yeah. And you did that for 2 weeks?
2 weeks, and the rest of the time I had a little house on a studio that I used as the base and the studio work, and then I created several large paintings for my galleries in Canada, and the rest of it was plein air.
So you were... You taught for 2 weeks and then you had 2 months there?
Basically, yeah. Yeah, yes. 2.5 months, yeah, to paint.
Yeah, so I saw a bundle of paintings we haven't looked at yet.
Yeah,
but we will.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can tell that's not a Canadian accent, so we might as well just delve into that Polish. That's Warsaw. You were born in Warsaw, weren't you?
Yeah, everybody says, where are you from? I said, from Canada. Well, no, because of your accent. Well, I came to Canada when I was 16. Now I'm 53. So, you know, quite a while ago, just before the Berlin Wall fell, it was still, we were behind the Iron Curtain and we didn't know when it's going to end. And I emigrated. My family emigrated in stages.
So when you were a kid in Warsaw, this is where you grew up, Warsaw?
Yes.
Yeah. So you were interested in art, I assume?
Oh, yes. I was interested in art pretty much since I was born. And both my family, my parents were extremely supportive. I grew up in a country where you're surrounded by art every day. You know, I lived 15-minute walk from the National Gallery. I would go there nearly every Saturday, you know, free as a child. You know, art was everywhere. So I did apprenticeship from age 6 till 16 with a master printmaker.
So how did you get that? So, I mean, at 6 years old.
My parents signed me up.
And were they in the arts?
No, my both parents scientists.
They were scientists.
Yeah, what, PhDs.
In what kind?
My father was a professor of experimental molecular embryology, and my mother had a master's in biology, and she worked at the National Biological Institute. Yeah.
But they obviously saw something in you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, to hook you up at 6 years old with a master printmaker?
Yes.
They saw something, or you were bugging them, or both.
I guess that I was constantly doodling or making a mess with whatever color I had in my disposal, and they say, "Well, maybe we can sign him up and for kind of children classes," and then kind of evolve a little bit more. And then when I graduated from public school, I went to a specialty art high school.
And you did that master the mentorship. From 6 years old till you graduated high school?
Yes, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, and then you went to an art school, right?
Yeah, and then I was, at the same time, I was doing an art school, and then unfortunately I could not complete it because I left for Canada. Then I completed just the last year of high school here in Canada, and then I went straight to Ontario College of Art, which I believe is one of the oldest art colleges in North America.
Mm. Yeah. And so you did. And so how old are you when you come to Canada? Are you?
I was 17? Was 16 and a half.
Almost 17. And how did that happen? I mean, that's a big deal to go from Poland to Canada as a minor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Well, like I said, my family emigrated.
So they came
in stages.
I see.
My first uncle, my mother's brother, emigrated in 68. And my other uncle emigrated in 1980. Then my mother, and I was left with my grandmother and my dad because my parents divorced. And then I emigrated, joined my mom, and then my grandmother came in a year later.
And that was a communist country at that point.
At that time was, well, socialist country,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and then
all different
times. It was a strange time. And then I'm in a first year of art college in autumn, and I'm watching live the Berlin Wall fell and everything changed. Boom.
Yes.
But I was already, I was already here and my family was here, and we contemplated going back, but, we got rid of our houses, so it was kind of no going back.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you went to art college.
Ontario College of Art and Design, what's called right now, in Toronto.
Yes.
Yeah, from 1989 till 1993, I graduated there from drawing and painting, fine art department with honors in 1993.
Nice. And what were you doing landscapes? Was that what you wanted to do?
Because
they teach a lot of abstract modern art in a lot of the art schools, at least in America. Mm. That seems to be the push. And they look at drawing and Western paintings and things as maybe not what you're supposed to learn in art school.
You're right to a certain extent. I think at the Ontario College of Art, that whole genre of abstract art start fading out when I came in. Mm. Then when I enrolled, the drawing and painting practicing became a norm again, which I believe it should be.
Yes.
And I was taking like 15 hours of live drawing a week.
Mm.
And then I did some experimental abstract painting classes. Of course, it was offered, and it was a lot of fun, drawing with really long sticks, doing kind of abstract, American abstract expression. It was a good balance with the traditional techniques. But in the beginning of the series, the year, I realized landscape, especially painting plein air, was something that really drew me from deep inside. And I love being on the land. I always love being in a forest, in the mountains. So seeing the Northern Ontario, when I came in, the subject matter of the group, famous Group of Seven, group of painters in Canada,
right.
I was really inspired. I took classes in landscape painting, enrolled with certain good professors. And it just took off and never looked back.
Yeah, I mean, you really were inspired by the Group of Seven. Yes. That's what inspired me with your paintings.
Yes.
Was when I saw it, I said, oh, this looks very much like the Group of Seven in his own world, his own kind of, you know, vision of what that is. And so you started right off with that. You go, I'm going to, this is kind of what I want to do. Landscapes with very kind of a high key color, thick paint kind of. You describe it for me.
Plein air painting and painting landscape, I think, ultimately gave me an opportunity to travel too.
Yeah, which is your real love, I think.
Both. You know, so
we're going to talk about that because you've been everywhere. You've been on every continent, haven't you?
Pretty close.
Painting. Yes.
So, you know, I love to take my paints with me everywhere I go and have the experience and a chance to try to capture that uniqueness of the landscape, you know, and each country, each continent, latitude has a different quality of light.
Right. And not only do you want to capture each country, but you're also wanting to capture places that no one else has ever been. Is that true to some extent?
Yeah. I mean, I've been to some areas where, you know, especially in Antarctica, where I don't believe people ever painted.
Yeah.
And also in Alaska and the high Arctic and Africa. You know, so yeah, it was to a certain extent, maybe when I was younger, that was kind of important to me.
Yeah.
You know, go where no painter ever went before.
I think I remember you telling me that maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
That's changed a little bit now. You don't have to go to where the grizzly bears are going to maul you.
Well, no, I was in the Yukon about 3 years ago for about a month and a half, and I had a great time. I traveled all over the Yukon and Alaska. But, you know, majority of the times those trips are, you know, entirely sponsored and funded by me. So I have to stick within the means I have, you know. Ultimately, you know, if funds were unlimited, I would like to travel to some areas, you know, like Kamchatka, probably even, you know, Greenland. But, you know, my biggest trip recently was self-guided trip through the whole entire Ecuador. I was there for 9 weeks. I traveled the whole country, north, south, east, and west, and painted for
Why
9 weeks.
Ecuador?
Just like always, I wake up one day, I go, dunk, I got to go to Ecuador. It was, you know, they always say that the Ecuador is one of the most diverse countries, environmentally diverse countries in the world. Mm-hmm. And true enough, it was. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time exploring different ecosystems up there. And I tell you, it's not easy to paint plein air up there because just like in Bolivia, it's the high altitude.
Mm.
You have to deal with the high altitude and, you know, hiking with your gear and then setting up. It requires completely different mindset than, you know, just, you know, in a comfortable lower elevation.
Yeah. And when you go to a place like Ecuador and you're there for how long? A month?
I was 9 weeks.
So 9 weeks, 2 months.
Over 2 months. Yeah.
So you're camping out the whole time pretty much?
Yeah, camping and using Airbnb. Ecuador is still very affordable, very cheap. You can find a quite decent accommodation for $20. So, you know, for an artist, it was kind of a dream come true.
And it's do you find where to go? Because, you know, there's dangerous places in Ecuador.
Well, yeah.
Very dangerous.
Yeah. So, of course, knowing my luck, 2 weeks in, they decided to announce national strike.
Yes.
And in that country, national strike meaning actually shutting down the whole country.
Yeah.
Majority of the population of Ecuador is indigenous people, and they pretty much kind of run the things. So when they're upset with the, you know, government at that time was about rising the prices of fuel by few cents.
Yes.
And some other stuff, and you know, people up there they don't make much money, so every cent counts.
Right.
That, by the way, they operate on the U.S. currency.
Yes, that's right.
People just went on strike, shut down all the highways, put up the barricades. I was just able to get in through a barricade into Cuenca, and then everything shut down. I was stuck in Cuenca. There was food shortages, no propane. And after 2.5 weeks being basically stuck and trying just to paint on the periphery of Cuenca, they made the deal. And within an hour, everything opened. Mm. And the gas went back to what was before. It was at 62 cents a liter.
And so when you're, how are you getting around? Do you get rent a car? Or you-
I for things like that, I don't... If I was just, you know, your regular backpacker, I would just rely on a bus because it's really cheap and safe to travel. But because I always has have those heavy oil paints, right? And always the extra stuff the artist needs, you know, bucket of mineral spirit. So I do rent a car. I rented a little car, good on gas, and I looked at it. I'm like, this car will never be the same ever again. Just like the car in Patagonia, because of the conditions of the road. Yeah,
because you're going to take it in some really rough places.
Yeah.
You're not worried about them going, this car has damage?
Oh, well, the car looked outside very fine. The inside, on the underneath, probably not.
Bang, bang, bang.
It all rattled. I remember the little Renault they gave me in Ushuaia.
Where's that?
At the very south end of South America.
Uh-huh. In Argentina?
Yeah. I said, this car has cracks in the front windshield. He goes, exactly. You're going to Patagonia. That's right. We're not going to give you anything better. By the time I finished with it, the doors were not closing because the whole frame was twisted.
Because you're just taking it on the most.
Well, it's just potholes, nonstop potholes, and not much pavement. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. And the road conditions in Ecuador, even so, a lot of it's paved. That's just horrific. Horrific.
Yeah. So, but you must love it because you spend whatever 9 weeks there, two of it maybe more than you needed to because of the country shutting down.
Yeah, it was, the adventure is definitely a big kind of, I guess, high that I get.
Do you speak Spanish?
A little, poquito, yeah. I get by, you know, always have the, you know, translator. It gives me a certain inspiration, different, outlook on life, you know. I wanna see how other people live and how they get by.
Yet you just do landscapes.
Yeah, I just do landscape.
Yeah, I mean, you're not doing people. You're not doing houses.
I do lots of architecture.
Okay.
Yeah, I do quite a bit of architecture. Since my visit in Japan, I started doing quite a bit of architecture.
Okay.
Yeah. That's cool. I love doing it.
Yes. And why did you add it?
I think it's being European, being born in Poland, I was always surrounded by spectacular architecture and everything from Romanesque to classical architecture. Seeing that pretty much on an everyday basis, living in Canada, we don't have that much except, you know, maybe Quebec City, right? Mm. Going to South America, especially, you know, you're starting to see spectaculars, Spanish colonial architecture.
Oh, yeah.
And then on top of it, you have the indigenous architecture, which is amazing, right? Which, you know, in places like Bolivia and Peru, they go 2,000 to 3,000 years.
Yeah.
You know, I find that combination of landscape, both Spanish colonial and indigenous architecture, just amazing, just powerful spiritual combination. Yeah, it's just very attractive.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And in Mexico, you know, of course, you know, churches, Spanish colonial architecture, and the colors, yeah.
So when you're in, let's just stick with Ecuador for right now, since that's recent, right? Relatively. Mm-hmm. When was that, by the way? How long ago?
Two summers ago.
And so you're traveling the entire country. Do you have it kind of locked out? Okay, here's what I want to do. Somehow you know where to go, or do you literally just go, I'm going here, this looks cool, then I'm going to go to another place? I mean,
both. I mean, I do make a certain plan by, you know, doing research, and then I have I always have a physical National Geographic adventure map. You know, they made that from that tin plastic, so it doesn't get ripped.
Yeah.
And then, as I read and watch things for my research, I highlight the areas on the route that I think I will find of interest. You know, if it's mountain range or interesting city or indigenous, site or site of a festival, I make those highlights on my map. And then as I start driving, I try to connect the dots. And of course, within those pre-designed dots, I find most dots that just come up, so I usually like to have more time than less time for adventure because that allows me a flexibility.
Do you have, so you're there for 9 weeks, but do you go, oh, I'm going to be here for 9 weeks? Or do you go, no, I'm going to be here for like 6 to 10 weeks or 12 weeks? In other words, is there any time guidelines for you on any of these trips?
I usually buy a return ticket.
Uh-huh. Your wife probably likes that.
She doesn't care. No. She's an adventurous spirit too. You know, she goes, yeah, you have to go for 3 months. That's fine. See you back at home.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm very, very grateful, fortunate. But I think the timeline comes from the experience. By now I know what it takes for me to get to a certain place. How long does it take to create a painting? If I'm in a comfortable location where I don't have to, fend off wild dogs, boars, revolutions, locals, gorillas, et cetera, then I can create 3 paintings a day.
Yeah.
But on average, when I'm traveling in a very new country where you have to constantly, watch what's going on, 1 painting average a day.
And when you say watch what's going on, you're literally meaning watching your back.
Yeah. Especially in Ecuador, yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. And you're doing a weird thing to them. You're setting up with paints and you're painting. They may never have seen anybody do that before.
Oh, yeah, you're totally right. I mean, sometimes I get the look like, what is he doing?
And why? Is this the government? Those kind of things. I could see it.
No, only in South Africa, I had a problem in National Park, yeah.
that sounds like a story.
Yeah. but I managed to talk myself out of it. In Ecuador, it's just curiosity.
Yeah.
But it's actually positive curiosity because a lot of time the curiosity comes from children. They've probably never been exposed to concept of art education, right? Yes. Especially, in a countryside. So when they see somebody who is blonde, right?
Mm-hmm. Grayish blonde.
Yeah. they find it curious, unusual. They want to ask questions.
Yeah.
They ask, how do you mix that color, in Spanish? So, sometimes it's not in places like that. Sometimes it's not the weather or the wildlife that's challenging, but the actually people who come by
and interrupt.
So you kind of have to find a flow, yeah. Sometimes you have to say, no, I can't talk to you. Or sometimes you take a break,
right,
and you just talk to them and then say, okay, enough. I have to go back to my work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not possible whatsoever. They just keep going.
Yeah. Well, you have a special skill set too, right? With martial arts.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. You're like a third degree black belt or something?
Sixth
degree black belt. But basically, so you're dangerous.
I don't know if dangerous, but since I was 16, I studied karate and different other martial arts, and I do that continuously. And it is for self-discipline, quality of life, health. I guess subconsciously, it just gave me a certain amount of confidence.
I would think, because if you're in an area that is inherently dangerous and you're watching your back, you know that you still have a skill set that probably you will be able to use if need be.
Minus the gun.
Minus the gun. Yeah.
Yeah,
gun rules everything.
Yeah, that's a different thing. But, when you're just dealing with one or two people, they're most likely, skills like that will come definitely handy, because when you train, the difference is there is training and there is training. When you train for 5 years, you have to think about it. Just like with painting.
Yes, I see.
But when you train for 30, 35 years.
Muscle memory is there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you don't have to think about it. So I don't, you know, if I have to paint something, a tree, you know, I just try to figure out general area shape, and then I just kind of, my hand just flows. The same thing, if something happens, like my hand responds, right?
Yes, of course.
So it actually, both things go hand in hand. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Have you had to use that muscle memory in these situations at all?
No, not yet. Not yet, and hopefully not. So, but, you know, it also comes with reading your environment.
I'm sure.
Being self-aware.
Yes.
Especially in places where, you know, like Quito is exceptionally dangerous for tourists. And, you know, I always, when I walk, I analyze my situation. You know, what's going to happen here? What's going to happen on front, behind me, right? Mm. So I'm always aware about that circle around me.
Mm. Do you find that the same for wildlife? You have that same sensibility? Because you're in areas, you know, I know you've been charged by grizzly bears and different things. Do you have that same sense, or is there less of a concern with the wildlife as there is with the human
life? Yeah, there's definitely
life.
Less concern, different type of concern.
Yes.
I mean, you know, sometimes, especially in the northern coast, you know, northern British Columbia and Alaska, you know, same thing. You walk in a coastal area along the rivers, or especially in southeast Alaska, there are sometimes beautiful meadows right on the beach.
Yes.
Those are prime habitat for grizzly bears because you have lots of lush plants to eat, you know, and the bears during the summer, you know, they try to fatten up. And along the rivers is the salmon, right? So those are the two areas where, you know, you have to walk with caution, make some sounds, say, you know, hello bear, I'm coming. And yeah, you know, it's quite often I run into a bear, you know, just around the corner, and I'm like, okay, well, you go that way, I go that way.
Mm.
Yeah. And sometimes you don't have a choice. You walk right beside each other.
Mm.
Yeah. I probably had over 120 encounters with black and grizzly bears in my lifetime, but never had a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being aware, probably not being afraid, helps as well, honestly.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, as probably silly as it sounds, not being afraid, but I think I always been a strong believer that if you are in nature, nature can hear you.
Absolutely.
Especially the animals. And if you're projecting aura of self-confidence, not afraid, but not being
stupid,
exactly, and full of yourself, just being respectful.
Correct.
Like you are just a guest. I think things just take care of themselves.
I agree with that, actually. I think there's an energy that's put off.
Exactly.
Either way, actually.
Either way, yes.
Yes, and they can sense it.
Well, because, you know, there's that old saying that the fear has a smell, right?
Yeah, no, that's right.
So.
Yeah, I do, you know, I like rattlesnakes and, you know, move them out of the road and these kind of things. And I have, you know, I completely respect and understand their behavior, so I don't feel zero fear. It doesn't mean I'm cavalier.
Oh, exactly.
You know, at all.
You can't
I
be cavalier.
I respect them completely.
Yeah.
And utterly.
Yeah. Especially, you know, in the far north, Yukon and Alaska, you have to be
aware
of what's going on, because that land not only can give you great inspiration and embrace you, but it can kill you in a second.
In many ways.
In many ways.
Yeah.
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 From, you know, falling from the, you know, from the mountain, falling into a crevasse, you know, drowning in the river, you know, you can't do stupid things.
Yeah, hyperthermia.
Oh, exactly.
And it doesn't take much, and you're
it
like,
doesn't
oops,
take much. No,
I'm in trouble. It's like the ocean, I think.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so, but you must enjoy being in that environment because you're constantly doing it. Do you think you can do your art without being in the environment like that?
It's funny that you asked me. I was thinking exactly the same concept as I was driving here from Mexico. you know, as I'm getting a little bit older,
yeah,
you said a little bit grayer,
right?
Can I just be, maybe be in a studio and be content?
Yes.
I'm back in my head, I was trying to convince, yeah, I can do that. But I'm going to try to travel as much as I can till the last days of my life, to be able to experience everything. You know, by now, I think I know what my preferences are in terms of the landscape and the way I feel around certain things, mm-hmm. And I hope to pursue those areas more and more. Like, for example, southwest of United States is one of my favorite places to paint. The Rockies, the whole British Columbia, Yukon, and Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, the Patagonia, Peru, Bolivia. Those are the thing, places I'm drawn to.
Mm. Yeah. But you've taken, and you've gone by motorcycle, right?
Yes.
Over a lot. Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think it's very interesting. Just why motorcycle and where have you gone?
I always, since a kid, I wanted to have a motorcycle. Mm. But of course, in Poland, my parents said you can't have a motorcycle, any kind of motorcycle.
Right.
When I came here, I was concentrating on my studies, and then I started traveling, and then, I had to be in one spot to take a, motorcycle course for safety and then go through all those hoops to get my driving license. So I never kind of made a point of doing it. But finally, when I settled in Nanaimo on Vancouver Island,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, I gotta get my license. I think I'm grown up enough not to kill myself.
Yes. How old were you?
Let's see that. I think I was 40. Yeah, 40, 41.
Yeah, okay.
So I took a course. It was a great course, safety course, learned lots of things, passed it with flying colors. And that was the time when I was going to see you in my old RV van. And just passed my last test. And then I went straight to Southwest to do the painting here. And then, I went through, I think, 9 different motorcycles, small, big ones, a couple big BMWs. Now I drive Triumph Tiger 900,
mm-hmm.
a good medium-sized motorcycle, triple cylinder. And I love, once again, I'm not into motocross and stuff because I'm too old for that. And I never really started when I was young. So I don't have that extensive. I mean, I can
that
ride.
Muscle memory.
I can ride dirt for sure, but not that extreme dirt as you see it on television. But my goal was to be able to take my paints on the back of my motorcycle and travel and mm-hmm. combine both, the motorcycling.
Two loves.
Seeing new places and painting all together.
Right.
So I did a big trip through Bolivia for 7 weeks, and we filmed their first season of Changing Landscape, Bolivia. That was a 2-season, and the second one was Vancouver Island. And I traveled with my best friend. He's also been traveling on another big motorcycle, BMW. And we, for each episode, we went to different location and the pivotal part of the episode was me finding the location to paint
mm-hmm.
and our journey to get there, painting, and then finding a place to rest and all the stuff that happened along the way.
And so this was, you did this as a show, right? And is that show still available anywhere online, or can they find it?
Yeah. The show at that time when it was released on Shaw Television.
Television?
Shaw Television, just big cable company in Canada.
Yes.
And then right now it's available for free on YouTube.
So you can see. And what's the name of the?
Changing Landscapes.
Yes.
TV.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you did Bolivia.
Bolivia.
And that took how long?
No, 7 weeks.
Yeah, that's long.
7 weeks. And that was a blast. We rented motorcycles in Peru. In Peru.
Did they have a clue what you were going to do with them when you rented these motorcycles?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. It was a big off-road motorcycles, no problem.
Yeah.
And then we drove to Bolivia, and then we came back. Yeah, it was quite an adventure.
Yes.
One of my best trips ever.
Okay. And what made it so good?
Well, I mean, being on that nice big bike, driving through Bolivia is one of my favorite countries to visit. Beautiful. It's just beautiful. I still haven't seen the southern part of Bolivia. Wonderful people, great food, amazing subject to paint, you know, everything from, you know, humongous, spectacular Andes, you know, the enormous size, mm-hmm. to ancient, indigenous sites, you know, with amazing architecture, to locals talking about aliens landing, you know. I mean, it was just magical. I mean, you can't get better than that, you know. And then you're driving these bikes through, you know, through Trans-American Highway, and there is no pavement.
Yeah.
Only 20% of Bolivia roads are paved, right? Yeah. So
that's rough.
I believe me. It was when I got back, it took about 2 months for my body to get back to kind of normal.
Yeah, because you were just banging and...
There's lots of weird sensation that happens.
I can imagine. And so you did Bolivia. What other countries did you do?
In South America?
That you did with the show.
Then a year later, we decided to do Vancouver Island on a motorcycle. And so we traveled for about 5 weeks to Vancouver Island, which is kind of our backyard. But, right. you know, it's still, I think, one of the big American magazines or TV stations voted Vancouver Island the most popular destination in North America this past year.
Yeah, it's so beautiful.
So, it's very beautiful up there. So we thought that we're going to bring it a little bit closer to people who might be interested in visiting. So we went all the way from the north to the south, you know, rainforest, ocean, indigenous culture to the capital of British Columbia, Victoria, you know, the English settlement. And that was really cool.
And did you do any others?
No, that were just two. I hope to do some others in the future. Yeah.
Same kind of thing on a motorcycle?
Yeah, of course. Always on a motorcycle.
And so what's the draw of it? Is it the draw of the adventure, or is it the draw of, or maybe it's a combination, the adventure on motorcycles, but ultimately doing what you love to do, which is paint?
I think when you're on, I know when you're on motorcycle, people see you differently.
Yeah, they do. I would.
Yeah. And then
there's a crazy guy.
Yeah, there's a crazy guy. You know, you have to have a, first of all, to be able to drive a motorcycle, or you want to drive a motorcycle, you have to have a certain mindset. And people who recognize that mindset are naturally drawn to you. They want to talk to you. And if you are traveling on an adventure bike, right? Or with a bike that has some gear on it, they know you're coming from somewhere else. So you right away spark a conversation.
Right.
So it's very easy to start a conversation when you are traveling on a motorcycle. And I love that. A lot of wonderful things can happen because of that. And, you know, you get invited to people's homes, you get shown things. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. And you also learn how to travel more in a minimalistic sense, right? So you only take essential, you know, change of clothes for 3 days. On a Thursday, you start washing, right?
Yeah.
And your underwear is hanging on the back of your bike, right? Yeah. You know, getting covered in dust, you know? And so you learn to live quite basic items. And it's amazing. That's totally possible. Yeah. But obviously, you know, you wouldn't be able to do that middle of winter in a high Arctic. Although some people drive a motorcycle for some reason or another, but you know, in a warmer country like South America, it's a little bit easier, you know, to do that. Although in Bolivia, we do drive a couple times through snowstorms, but then you lower your altitude, and again, it's much more warmer climate. Yeah,
you're addicted. I don't know if that's a strong word, but it seems like it. The unknown, curiosity, creativity.
Yeah, curiosity, yes.
Yes, I can see that. That's why you love it. Because you can meet these individuals that will take you in and you can make contact on something that's completely and utterly new and beyond your control, but it happens. And, you know, just asking that question, could you do just studio work? And when you do your soul search coming down, you say, no, I can't. I still have to do this. There's something about that.
Yeah,
moves you. It seems like to me. Again, I'm not living in your head, but
you know, that leads me to another statement that I was thinking the other day. Somebody asked me, one of my students, well, can you explain how you do this painting, right? Because, you know, all the students want to know,
right?
You know, how the master wants, you know, right. does the painting.
Right.
And, you know, back in my head, I'm like, I have no freaking idea how to do that, how to explain that. But of course, you know, then I think, well, I kind of know. But, you know, that led me to a further evaluation of that is I try to reinvent myself with each painting. I don't try to follow and fall on a predictable formula of painting. I mean, my paintings are very recognizable.
Yes,
like
yeah.
you can tell it's by yeah. Dominic, obviously.
Yes.
But in each painting, I try something new. I try something, a new color combination that I learned from a plein air painting or a new type of brushwork that would describe the contour a little bit differently. So I never settle mm-hmm. on a comfortable. Mm-hmm. So, and that's also leads me to, you know, the travel adventure. You know, adventuring is not a comfortable sport.
Let's say. I would think not.
No, lots of times it's not. It's, but every time I learn something new, so it's, you know, it adds to
the curiosity,
my experience yeah. of life. You know, what I have, I don't have much money as an artist, but I have stories. I'm rich in stories.
Yes.
I can talk all night for probably 7 days about the stories and the type of experiences and conclusions I got from the travels and, you know, very hard experience of painting on the land, because it's not easy. People think it's romantic. Well, it might be. I look, you know, if you stand behind a nice glass in a warm room, looks romantic. But when you're painting plein air, it requires a humongous amount of mental and physical dedication to be able to do that.
Like you do with your karate and the other things. Same thing.
Because we have not only sometimes you have to withhold in the cold. On other extreme heat.
Yeah, bugs, wind, rain, ice.
Yeah,
sleet,
lots of weird
animals,
things.
People. Yeah,
ocean tide coming
right.
in. Oh yeah. It's very. Very seldom you just have to deal with one little thing. Usually it's quite few elements that are coming at you.
Oh. I would give this a term. I don't know if anybody has used this term before, but and it's experiential painting. Experiential
yeah.
painting.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing. It's experiential. So it's not only the painting, it's the whole journey.
Yes.
And what's involved with that journey. Because the painting can't evolve unless you have those stimuli, I think, and you're still searching even in each painting for something a little new or different.
Yes.
And that's the experience
yeah.
that you want. And that's what the high is. That's what you...
Yeah, you put it very well.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very interesting. I think there's others like you.
I think so, yeah.
But sure. I don't think there's a lot.
But I think
everyone that goes out and paints plein air at some component is looking for that sense, because I have a lot of plein air painters and some of them take it to extremes, you know, or what might seem extremes to mm-hmm. people like myself or other,
yeah.
not to me, I actually understand it, but you know, they go to places that are very difficult
yeah.
and experience those, and that they can't get, I don't think they can get those paintings unless they do it.
I always tell my students, I do my best work when I'm most miserable out there.
You're most focused.
Yeah, because, and usually this has to do due to weather conditions.
Yeah.
I don't have time to think. Mm-hmm. I respond. So the whole mindset changes. And I look at those paintings and I'm like, wow.
How did I do that?
Yeah, how do you do that? I don't even know how I did that, because you just responded.
Yeah, you're in the moment.
In the moment.
Yeah, it's muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And it's like an athlete being at a big game. You know, you literally lock in and zone in, and you just let it flow from the gut, yeah. heart, whatever. I yeah. see that.
It's a priceless experience, and it's also a priceless memory. And it's so intense because you're doing something so physical and intellectual together.
Yes.
That when I look at some of the paintings, you know, images of the paintings that I did over the last few couple decades. I remember each moment
and how
I got there, right?
Sure.
I probably don't remember the previous day, but I do remember that, you know, 3 hours around that painting.
Yeah.
And I always make a point, and that probably would be interesting to for fellow artists and collectors. I always keep one or two paintings from each adventure for myself.
Mm.
And at home, I have a little kind of private collection.
Museum.
And I have like, I bought long time ago, about 50 like plein air frames,
yes.
You know, beautiful frames. Like some are gold, some are black, and some are silver. And I just rotate the paintings every few months and change them on the wall.
Yeah.
So each year I add
a photographic album done in paint.
That's right. So each year I usually add, you know, 4 or 5, you know, my best sketches, which are never for sale.
Definitely. Yeah. And on your paintings, you also do something interesting is that you document each one. Maybe you could tell people how you do the back of it with your fingerprint.
That documenting.
Yeah.
Yes. Since the end of my studies at the Ontario College of Art.
So 1993.
Yes. I decided to come with a very unique signature besides just, you know, written signature. What I do, I have my favorite color contrast, which is complementary contrast of blue and orange.
Yes.
So I do a big stripe, you know, maybe with the brush that wide,
yes.
About 2.5 inch wide on the back of the canvas, maybe 8 inches long. And then once this is dry, I dip my thumb in a cadmium orange.
Yes.
And then I press my thumb in. So each of my paintings is marked up like that, you know, regardless if it's a plein air sketch or a big studio painting.
Yes. So when we finally get to using thumbprints as our way of securing our bank accounts and everything, all you need to do is go buy a Dominic Modolinsky painting and you can crack his code.
Yeah.
You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, I thought about that before. I don't think the acrylic paint.
You might have to buy a couple paintings.
Yeah, to match them. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because technology changes. Things change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, today's artists may be putting a chip in the painting. You know,
yeah.
And have it on the blockchain, so it cannot be. You know, you don't even need a chip for that. You can just put everything on blockchain and documents. But I think the important component of this for other artists is you recognize I want mine to always be known as mine and nobody knocking them off or saying this is somebody else's.
Yeah.
Because you understand innately since you graduated in 1993 that this is a journey and it's my journey and I want people basically to remember me and know who this was, whatever that was, and not to try to change it in some fashion because people do fake paintings. You don't know where you, as an artist, you have no idea how you're going to be seen in long term, you know, art history. And I'm not sure it matters to most.
Mm-hmm.
I think that matters, I think, for most is doing the work and being an artist. But at the same time, I think the ones that have self-recognition go, that may be true, but I still want to document it. So for like Maynard Dixon, it makes it very easy because he documented everything. He saw that he got that.
Mm-hmm.
You do that. A lot of artists do that.
Yeah.
You know, Ed Mel documents. One of the first things they should do if they're starting out is to go, I'm going to keep a log of some type and do something.
Yeah.
I think you take it to the upper end of that, which I think is good. Because have you ever forgotten to do that on any of your paintings?
The thumbprint?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was funny. I was up north probably 15 years ago and I had some dry 11, 14 paintings from the field. Just came back from Alaska. I was in Whitehorse. So I was just sending them, as I always do, to my gallery in Banff in Canada House. And I didn't have those two colors, two acrylics. I'm like, whatever. I just sent them. I get a phone call, email. That was before cell phones, I think. Or I didn't have a cell phone. I get an email from Barbara, the owner at that time, and said, Dominic, where is the signature? Well, I have no paint. Well, you should have got the paint. Clients are complaining. We are sending those paintings to your studio when you get back home. They're already sold. Yes. But all you have to do is do your thing, and then you send it back.
That's true.
That's okay. I will do that.
Yeah.
And since then, I make sure I never forget.
Yeah, there you go.
Because, you know, people are now used to it.
I would. Yeah. I would look at it. That would be one of the first things I would want to know. Yeah. And I would go, why not, if you didn't?
Yeah. Oh. So, you know, laziness doesn't pay off.
I wouldn't consider you in the lazy component of life. So, what's your next adventure? You just finished Mexico.
So I'm getting home. My wife is probably looking forward to having me back home. You know, honey list is growing a little bit longer. That's fine. I'm looking forward to do some work at home. Since I'm on Vancouver Island, I will probably try to do a little bit more hiking in some areas that I haven't been before and kayaking. And then end of August, I'm going to the Canadian Rockies, you know, the Banff, Lake Louise area. And I'm going to be painting plein air for 5 weeks straight up there, preparing for a solo show at Canada House up there that has represented me since for the last 20 years.
And where is that? Where are they located?
Banff, Alberta.
Oh, yeah, Banff. Yeah. That's right. And Banff, yes. Yes, I've been there.
So I'm looking forward to that because it's going to be a beautiful time in the Rockies. You know, as you know, that it's the transitional time and all the high elevations go, you know, orange and red. And then you have the tamaracks, trees that go yellow.
I'm sure when those start to come, you can feel it. Yeah, I mean, you know.
Spectacular.
Yeah, it's like a wine, a vineyard coming.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because those are your colors.
Those are my colors. And of course, you know, hoping to get lots of reference images, you know, while I'm painting there. Yeah.
And so what's your Instagram account and Facebook account where people can follow you?
Yeah, so it's at D. Modlinski.
Mm-hmm.
That's my Instagram account. And my website, it's paintingjourneys.com.
Yes.
And as an interesting fact, I was one of the very few first Canadian artists who actually got the website. And I happened that to have since 97.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course, you know, paintingjourneys.com went through many different versions.
Yes.
But yeah, I had it for a very, very long time.
That's a long time. Yeah. We got ours in 96.
Okay, well, oh, yeah.
But we were both before Google.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's, so I'm quite happy.
Yeah,
quite that's happy with
that. So, yeah, you've been there forever. Yeah. And you can get them here. MedicineManGalley.com. We also have. Not that many. We don't get that many work, but we do get works from you, which we appreciate. You know, I saw your work. I don't remember how I saw it, but I remember seeing it going, oh, yeah, that's special. That's like Group of Seven stuff right there.
So, since you're asking me questions, but I ask you a question as an art dealer,
because
probably people will find that interesting. What makes an art dealer of your caliber, your experience, let's say, interested in the work of an artist that you might be considering for representation, what makes you interested in my art, right? I mean, you found me in Canada, right?
Yeah.
And you are here.
For what you, I can speak for you on terms of yours, it had to do with the way you laid the paint down, the subject matter you chose, and specifically, too, the color. Mm-hmm. The colors, the way you used the colors was really... spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what art is, right? So that's what I'm looking at. Any artist is something that speaks to me. There's things that you can look at and go, oh, that's sellable, or that's a, you know, marketable, but does it speak to you? So I'm more interested in, does it speak to me? And so, and I can recognize your paintings immediately. It's the color and the way you lay down the paint. And then, of course, your subject matters are all very, you know, interesting and unique. But it's, you know, it's that color sensibility, I think, as much as anything that I like.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, there's the answer. I know it when I see it, pretty much.
Yeah.
And I also know it when I see it and I go, that's not it for me.
Right.
And so, and that's hard because sometimes I turn away people and they're good artists.
Mm-hmm.
And it has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with me.
Right.
So I had 5 artists yesterday contact me.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, and there were some very nice, good artists in there, but it's like, It's, you know, at this point in my career, I have to be extremely choosy and, you know, because you're committing to somebody as a family.
Yeah.
And you also have other artists that you have to protect as well.
Yeah.
You know, so that's,
that's
a difficult thing for an art dealer, I think.
I, from my art dealer in Canada House, I heard, that was quite a long time ago, when I think I was starting with them, she said to me, I have to be an excited to speak about an artist's work. I have to be, I have to relate personally to it because, you know, otherwise it's just dollar numbers and an item, right?
No, that's right.
You have to be passionate about it.
You have to be, able to express your emotion of how this painting or paintings of this person moves you.
Yes.
And because if you can't, I don't know how you, you know, sell it. You know, I want things that will go in my house. If they go in my house, they can go in your house.
Right.
And then the other component for works that are deceased, there's a historical component that also comes in to it. So it's like, you know, this is where it was when he or she did it and why that's so important.
Yeah.
You know, and deceased work, you can look back and go, this is the arc of this artist's life. And here are the issues that they were dealing with when they're painting this. Mm-hmm. And you can see, maybe often, you can see how it's reflected in what subject they choose, how they do it, the colors. And, you know, Fritz Schulder would be a good example.
Yeah.
You know, some of his things were very dark, very difficult to look at for me emotionally, but it also makes them great.
Right. Of course.
So
they're truthful.
Yeah. They're very truthful.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all want that if we can.
I think when an artist portrays the inner truthfulness, it just speaks for itself.
Yeah,
you can't fake that.
No, it's like writing a book.
Exactly.
You know, people say, "Oh, this sounds like you," and I'm like, "Yeah, it probably should sound like me," because if I don't allow myself to be in some of those books in some form or fashion, you know, I'm not doing a service of really.
Right.
You know, telling the story, because it has to affect you in some way or form for you to get that emotional sense to put it in words. Same with a song. You know, a song should resonate to people, go, oh, yeah, I was there, you know, and because that person was probably there when they wrote that song. They're like, oh, yeah, I felt that. I remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Taylor Swift. I mean, that's what she's good at.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure that's what you're good at too. So, I mean, you have a passion clearly about what you do. You go all over the world and, you know, you do these things that most people would consider to be on the upper end of insanity.
I think it gives, well, ultimately, you know, it gives you a sense of direction and, life path, right? Sometimes as frustrating as it is, you know, you don't have a choice. You have to follow it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, your path is definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, you're still thinking about it, right? I mean, as you come here, you're thinking, can I do, you know, this in the studio?
Yeah.
Because you could. You have the ability. You're a great painter. You can do that. But it would take the curiosity, fun, and the juice out of it.
Exactly. Yeah, the juice out of it. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So, see how much fun this is?
Well, you ask very, you know, poignant and very good questions,
Well, you've lived a different life than most people, and I find that interesting.
Okay.
So, I get the same juice out of hearing stories like this, because it's like, who does that? And why? And why?
Right.
That's really, you know, I want to get to the and why.
Well, I you know, the people ask me that question quite often, and I could stay in a studio. I could live much safer, predictable, cheaper lifestyle. Yes.
Right.
You know, but, you know, I would just die inside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I got it. So, I think that's a good ending point.
Yeah.
Unless you have anything else you want to say.
No, I think that was really good. I think we covered a lot of ground. A lot of miles.
Yeah. It even makes it easier for me, too. Even though I kind of inherently know some of your story, your backstory, but it's not the same as hearing it out of your mouth and looking at you and visually seeing, you know, the intensity that comes with it. That I can translate now to when I show paintings of yours and go, Let me tell you the story.
Right.
Okay. And why. Here, he had to have the juice to get to this place to make it work.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, I know you're headed out to somewhere. Who knows where next? But
well, I'm heading north to Canada. I should cross in about 3 days.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Do you even know where you end up tonight, or you just go until you
drop? On a route like that, I just drive as much as I can. Try not to travel dark, and then just pull over into one of the rest areas, which are so popular here in the States. I can sleep in my van and then wake up usually at 5 o'clock in the morning and keep on driving.
Yeah, you know you're safe there.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. It's on a way down. I took the coastal route, you know, from Seattle all the way down to Los Angeles, but the highway was bad. Tons of traffic. Southern California was just a zoo.
Yeah, it's just the opposite
gas,
of what
the
you
gas
mean.
Was over $6 per gallon.
Yeah.
And so my Canadian friends down in Mexico said, no, go to Tucson and straight to Osoyoos.
Yeah.
I did that route before. Yeah. Well, that's easy.
Yeah, and get gas for $3.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
In Arizona.
Yeah.
All right, Dominic. Very good. Thank you for taking the time. Let's go look at your paintings. That'd be fun.
All right. That was awesome.